I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. John F. Kennedy is remembered fondly by many. His death was mourned by millions. But what was Jack Kennedy like behind closed doors? In a new book, Hardball host Chris Matthews seeks to answer that question, interviewing everyone from prep school classmates and college friends to war buddies and political associates. While many Americans remember Kennedy for his golden youth, he was in fact a sickly boy who lived in seclusion. And although he appeared to be athletic, he preferred reading. A week after his death, Jackie Kennedy said history made him what he was. This little boy in bed so much of the time was reading history. Chris Matthews talks with us about the life of JFK and this year's presidential contest on Up to Date, following this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. Supreme Court has just ended its first of three straight days of arguments on the constitutionality of the national health care law. We have the latest from NPR's Julie Rovner.
The justices are expected to decide by late June whether Congress was acting within the Constitution in requiring most Americans to have health insurance starting in 2014. Since the health law passed 2 years ago, the fight over that individual mandate has raged, even though the idea was first floated by Republicans. And the court's decision is expected to come smack in the middle of a heated presidential contest where health care remains one of the top issues. Perhaps in recognition of that fact, the justices are devoting 6 hours of oral arguments to the law this week, more than for any case in 40 years. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
A big gathering is underway in Sanford, Florida, to mark 1 month since an unarmed black teen was fatally shot by a neighborhood watch volunteer. As NPR's Joel Rose reports, high-profile figures are taking part in the event to protest what they call a case of racial profiling and inadequate police response.
Civil rights leaders, including the Reverend Jesse Jackson, plan to march through the streets of Sanford, calling for justice for the parents of Trayvon Martin. The march will end at the Sanford Civic Center for a special meeting of the City Commission. Martin's parents and others are expected to address the community on the one-month anniversary of their son's death. The shooter, Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman, has not been charged with a crime, but a lawyer advising Zimmerman says it was an act of self-defense. A Florida grand jury is expected to hear evidence in the case next month. Joel Rose, NPR News, Sanford, Florida.
The wife of the U.S. soldier accused of slaughtering 17 Afghan villagers earlier this month tells NBC there is no way her husband, Sergeant Robert Bales, could have done it. Appearing on the Today Show, Carolyn Bales says her husband displayed no signs of stress before he deployed to Afghanistan, his fourth after Iraq. Bales says she spoke with her husband by telephone twice since his detention. She told NBC that while they could not discuss details during the monitored conversation, Sergeant Bales seemed, quote, a bit confused as to where he was and why he was there. NATO is reporting another deadly attack by a member of the Afghan security. Two British troops were killed in southern Afghanistan by a local soldier. Such attacks increased in the aftermath of Quran burnings at a U.S. base and the killings of Afghan villagers allegedly by a U.S. soldier. Thousands of people across Southern California still without power after yesterday's storm. It dumped nearly an inch of rain in downtown Los Angeles and left a blanket of snow in the mountains. At last check on Wall Street, Dow Jones Industrial Average up 123 points at 13,204. NASDAQ gaining 38. It's at 3106. This is NPR. A new survey from the National Association of Business Economics reveals broad belief among economists that spending cuts alone cannot solve the U.S. deficit problem. Economists believe more tax revenues must be part of any effective deficit reduction program. Jay Bryson of Wells Fargo is the policy survey chairman.
What's striking, I think, here is just the overwhelming majority. You know, the 85 to 90% of the respondents say that, you know, both tax increases and spending restraint need to play some sort of role in terms of deficit reduction going forward.
Bryson says a survey can do some good if it brings Republicans and Democrats closer in budget and planning discussions. The outgoing Senegalese president, who lost a runoff vote on Sunday, says he has kept his word to the nation by conceding defeat. From the capital, Dakar, NPR's Fabia Quist-Arkton reports the president-elect says a new era has begun with Senegal demonstrating democratic maturity.
A statement from veteran President Abdoulaye Wade says when the results indicated his erstwhile protege, Macky Sall, had won, as I always promised, I called him up Sunday night to congratulate him. Many in Senegal worried Wade might resist a prompt and gracious exit after insisting on seeking a third term in office. Now it's time for business for President-elect Sall, who told the Senegalese he's ready to deliver on their many expectations. And it's payback time. Sall enjoyed the backing of nearly a dozen presidential candidates who were defeated in the first round. People now wonder whether the Anyone But Wade coalition will endure. Ophelia Quistanton, NPR News, Dakar.
I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org.
Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. He was a man who knew pain, admired courage, and hated boredom. John F. Kennedy was many things to many people. Jackie Kennedy called her husband elusive and unforgettable. To Chris Matthews, the Hardball host who's written a new biography of JFK, Kennedy was a fighting prince, never far from trouble, never accepting the world he found, never wanting to be his father's son. He was, Chris Matthews has said, a far greater hero than he ever wished us to know. Besides hosting Hardball on MSNBC, Chris Matthews is also host of the syndicated Chris Matthews Show. His new book is Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero, and Chris Matthews joins us this morning from WBUR in Boston. Chris, welcome. Nice to have you today.
Thank you, Stephen.
You call him a far greater hero than he ever wished us to know. What do you mean by that?
His deep health problems that came with him at birth and persisted to the very end. He was in pain most of the time, and in very much World War II fashion, Greatest Generation fashion, never complained and certainly never explained his health challenges. He had many diseases as a kid, and the most important one, when he was away at boarding school at Choate, most of the time he thought he had leukemia. And so he was bedridden. He was in the infirmary more than anyone, in fact, most of the time. He was lonely. He was a reader, much more of an intellectual than I think people realize, certainly as a young man. And then, of course, Addison's disease kicked in with the first episode, which required him getting the last rites of the church in 1947, again in 51. And then, of course, the back problem, the congenital back problem, which had begun in his youth, was worsened by what happened in World War II when his PT boat was cut in half by the destroyer. And he felt like he was dying at that point. And that, after a year of butchery here up in Boston, the failed surgery, he continued to the point where in 1954, he almost died again, had the last rites of the church again when they basically botched the operation in New York for his back, when he really reached the point he couldn't even walk anymore. And he figured he'd spend the rest of his life in a wheelchair at best. So he took a last-minute chance on that operation. It didn't work very well. They tried it again. There was complications, and in fact, at one point again, he had to have the last rites. And so he got into the White House after 4 years of hard work campaigning with Ted Sorensen at his side. And even then, he had all these problems requiring steroids. The leukemia turned out to be colitis, and he was taking steroids for that for years. Bob Dalek's done great work on that, the historian. And it turns out that he was probably degenerating his muscle and his skeletal strength almost in an early onset of osteoporosis early on in his life. So his bones were just getting weaker and weaker. And at the end, he was taking six shots of Provocaine every day, direct injections, just to survive. And so he was really in bad shape. And again, what made him a hero, and in many other ways, of course, but in this way, he never complained about it. He would use forklifts to get up on Air Force One. He would use crutches most of the time, and all the time being covered for. I mean, I talked to his naval attaché, who denied it to my face, and then I have all the pictures showing him on crutches, and we all remember the pictures of him on crutches. He looked at my face and said, he never used crutches. Well, they were even covering for him here 50 years later, a lot of the people. I think it was a great story of personal suffering in a man we thought had it all.
Chris, he didn't complain. Why?
I don't know. I think because in that generation, men didn't.
Yes.
Like so many of our fathers and grandfathers came back from the war, and they just never told about the horrors of war or what war was even. I remember my daddy was in Naval Intelligence back in Philadelphia, never went overseas. I said to him one time, don't you wish you'd gone over? You'd have stories to tell. And he said, all my friends were over, and they'd never tell any stories. And because my uncle was one of the tank commanders that went into Auschwitz, and my other uncle was a major. I think he reached colonel in the Army Air Corps in Australia. Uncle George told some stories, but they weren't braggarts like today. They certainly weren't like boomers who always whined and complained about their situation. I think Brokaw had it right, Tom Brokaw, in his book. And I think we all know it from family experience.
The Greatest Generation you're talking about.
Yes, that's right.
You know, Chris, you're fascinated by John F. Kennedy. You've written this book, obviously, and also a previous book on Kennedy and Richard Nixon. What was it about him? Was it just the timing of his ascent to politically combined with your coming of age politically?
Well, I have, I don't know about you, Steve. I've got three people that if I see their names, it doesn't have to be in bold print, I'll read the article. You know, I just know I will, whether it's Jack Kennedy or Winston Churchill or Ernest Hemingway. I'm sure I have a much longer list, but that would be the big three, where I just read, I want to know about them. I want to know, for some reason, everything about Hemingway. I want to know his story. I want to know his adventures. I think because they're pathfinders. I think because somehow certain people become pathfinders. Hemingway, for example, taught us, you know, the excitement of Paris in the 20s, which Woody Allen, of course, satirized, and I thought a brilliant movie.
Great movie.
In Africa, I went to the Peace Corps in Africa. I'm sure it had something to do with Tarzan and, I don't know, African Queen, but somewhere I really wanted to go to Africa, and I did, and the Black Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa. And I know that the Churchill has inspired me for years. I'm in a group called the Churchill Center. And we have meetings around the world. And I know he inspires me because it's the one man standing alone in his case in 1940 in May when nobody else wanted to fight the Nazis.
Right.
He led he basically saved the honor of the Western world in standing up to them. So I can explain it literally in some cases, but it's just interest, I think. Just interest. I want, even back when I was a kid growing up as sort of a Goldwaterite like Hillary was in the late 50s and very early 60s.
Yeah,
I was rooting. I just wanted to meet Kennedy. I found him fascinating.
Did you ever meet him?
As a person. No, I was at Holy Cross up in Massachusetts, right near where I'm at right now, in college freshman year when he was killed. So I was way too early. I mean, Bill Clinton was a unique case of a guy my age who was able to get that close. I mean, to be a high school boys' state kind of thing and boys' nation. And have that unique opportunity to race up and grab hand with them. That is a unique opportunity, I think.
Well, Kennedy's presidency, Chris, it was cut so short. Are you convinced he would have gone on to presidential greatness or not?
Well, he was a hero at whatever age. I mean, I think, yes. Let me tell you why. I mean, everybody of my age knows this, and you know this. I mean, I guess as my son Michael, who graduated from Brown a few years ago, said to me, and he helped me with the book and pulling together a lot of it, he said, just think, he took a segregationist party and in 1 year turned it into a civil rights party. Right through his presidency, the Democratic Party was dominated by all the chairmen of all the Senate committees, for example, were segregationists. Fulbright, the whole bunch of them. Smathers from Florida and all those famous names, Sam Ervin, all those guys were segregationists. And he basically said, no, that's over. And he went and took the federal troops into Ole Miss, integrated that university. The following year, in June of 63, he took the federal marshals Nicholas Katzenbach, pushed George Wallace out of the way to integrate Vivian Malone, whose sister is married, as we know, to the attorney general now, to Eric Holder. That's quite a change. Mm-hmm. I think he really led the fight on civil rights from the presidential stand. And then, of course, all that stuff about optimism was true. I mean, in idealism. I was in the Peace Corps in the first group going into Swaziland back in the 60s. I think Kennedy did a lot of mental health that nobody had done before. He certainly did a lot on civil rights. He did the space program, which was so scientifically inspiring, the Apollo program. He launched that. I think the Alliance for Progress was a real going back to the good neighbor policy of FDR. I think on just about every front, Medicare, he fought that right up to the edge where Johnson was able to carry it over. I think on higher aid to higher education, he really did that. I think in just amazing numbers of areas, he was, and also most importantly, he got us through the Cuban Missile Crisis and through the most dangerous point in the Cold War through skill and guts.
You know, we're visiting with Chris Matthews of Hardball, who's written a new book on Jack Kennedy. You know, you talk about Churchill, this one man standing up for Western Europe, and you just mentioned the Cuban Missile Crisis. Speaking of one man standing up against his whole array of military commanders who were stacked against him, what was it in John F. Kennedy, Chris, that allowed him to sort of push back against the very staunch advice of his own military commanders? Where did he get that fortitude to do that when he was a very young president at the time?
Well, that's, of course, the great question of grace under pressure. And I think part of it was intellectual. He had read Barbara Tuchman's Guns of August about how World War I began by a series of actions that led to a chain reaction, and how each government made the right decision at that moment that they felt they had to make, but each one led to the next that led to a world war. And he didn't want to do that. He was very much aware of nuclear war and its potential. And he didn't see it as a metaphor for machismo or anything else. He saw nuclear war as the end. And so he was always aware of the steps that he could take that would lead to it. He knew, for example, that Khrushchev had warned him before the Cuban Missile Crisis, if the United States moved on Cuba, he would move on Berlin. It was a literal threat. And, of course, he knew that once Khrushchev moved on Berlin militarily to cut off access rights to West Berlin, which was under American, French, and British control, that we would have to go to nuclear at some point because they had 350,000 Warsaw Pact and Red Army troops. And we on our side, on NATO's side, had a combined force of 15,000. It would have been a matter of hours before we were overrun. And he knew politically he couldn't let that happen. So he didn't want that tripwire to be broken. And then, of course, he was thinking, too, about killing Russians. He knew that if we went into Russia in any way, whether it was just a surgical strike, well, actually, the surgical strike was pushed out as a preemptive because you needed to knock out the anti-aircraft fire. You had to basically go for a full invasion. And he knew that that would kill a lot of Russians. It turned out there were highly exponential numbers of Russians there, like 50,000 there. He thought there were like 10. We would have been in a land war with Russians if we had invaded Cuba. But he knew that Khrushchev would have to act. And that famous scene in the film 13 Days, which I believe is accurate, he said to LeMay, what do you think the Russians will do if we invade Cuba or strike the targets? And LeMay said, nothing. Well, Kennedy wasn't willing to take that risk because he knew Khrushchev was surrounded by hawks just as he was. And the most powerful statement I could come up with about why it was a great moment for us in saving the world is that Khrushchev in his memoirs said that had we attacked the missile sites in Cuba, he was prepared to use the last two missiles he had, and he said they might be big ones, in other words, intermediate range ones, to hit New York. He would hit New York, and he would teach us what he wouldn't kill everybody, but he'd kill millions of people, as he put it, and he would teach us what it's like to fight a war on our own territory. Now, that was, of course, short-sighted, because how could he not have known that no American president could withstand that politically? Had we been hit in New York, even in response to an attack on Cuba, it would have been an all-out attack on the Soviet Union and its satellite countries. Yeah. Kennedy would have had to do that horrific, world-ending decision. Kennedy was so close to the edge. And as you pointed out a moment ago, he was up against Curtis LeMay. He was up against, Dean Acheson, the great Cold Warrior. He was up against McGeorge Bundy, his own national security advisor. So it was only on his side was Bobby, who always came through in the clutch, And who else? Oh, McNamara was very smart about modern weaponry. He understood it.
Well, just to give our listeners a sense of how forceful General Curtis LeMay was, and that's a name oftentimes associated with Vietnam these days, General LeMay later said that the decision not to invade Cuba at that point was the greatest defeat in our history. Wow.
Yeah, that's who you're dealing with there.
Yeah.
A man who didn't understand the potential of that leading to a world war and to a world-ending cataclysm. I mean, look at how it took us all these years to deal with 9/11. Imagine if we'd lost 70 million people. Imagine if the other side had lost that many. Imagine if we'd continued to fight. I don't know what would have ended a world war once it began nuclear. I think both sides would throw everything they had into it, and the face of this planet would have been very different today.
You know, there's so much shrewdness that comes through in this book that goes even beyond the missile crisis, Chris. I'm thinking of what you wrote about how Kennedy walked in at the very last minute before that very famous first debate with Richard Nixon in 1960. Yeah. And I'm also thinking about how the newly elected president finessed the idea right after the election that he indeed was the victor in this extraordinarily tight election with Nixon. And he had to do something to signal to the rest of the world and the country that, hey, he's the winner, Nixon's the loser, we have to preempt this idea of any recount. Tell us about those two moments.
Well, there was so much strategy and tactic in that first debate.
Yeah.
The coming in at the last minute, Nixon and he had been very friendly for years up until this point, up until the campaign. And I don't know when they actually broke apart in terms of emotions, but they'd always been friendly. In fact, as I point out in the book, Kennedy told Charlie Bartlett, the man who introduced him to Jackie, he was very close with him. He told Bartlett, if I lose the primaries, I'm voting for Nixon. This is as fresh as the New Year's Eve before the general election, before the campaign began. So Kennedy was pretty open-minded to Nixon up until then. But he was tricking him. He was the game that was played on makeup, for example. They were both asked by Don Hewitt, who, of course, later became famous for
60 Minutes,
executive producer of 60 Minutes. Mm-hmm. He was the director. He said, "You guys want makeup?" And Kennedy said, "No, I believe it." And Nixon, of course, was into the macho game again, and he said no too, because he had known that Kennedy had made fun of Humphrey for wearing makeup. Kennedy, of course, his version of makeup was to keep his constant tan. Kennedy was very narcissistic that way. He was always keeping his tan up and his hair combed and brushed and a massage so he wouldn't lose his hair like his dad. And I mean, Kennedy was very aware of looks. Let's not kid ourselves. But in that moment, he sort of head-faked Nixon. Nixon went outside. Kennedy went into his room, and Bill Wilson, his TV advisor, put makeup on him. Not much, but just enough, as he put it, to cover the pores, because those lights were very bright in those days on television.
Very hot, too.
Very hot and unforgiving. Nixon, on the other hand, went out and got lazy shave. But Nixon was pretty aware of his problem. He had a Mike Dukakis or a guy. He's one of these guys with really a thick beard. And it, like, even right after you shave, Nixon said 30 seconds later, you can see it darken. and he just had that kind of, Black Irish, I guess we could still call him, that dark beard. And he couldn't do much about it. And he would say, in fact, Walter Cronkite interviewed him one time, why don't people like you? And he said, one of the reasons they don't like me is this beard. And it's the Herb Bloch image. And he was very aware of it, that it was his problem. Kennedy, on the other hand, was, of course, ruthless about it. He put on a makeup. He already looked like $1 million. He'd been campaigning in California in the sun. And he always kept his makeup. He always kept his color up because it was covering up his health problems. Kennedy was always showing off to look good because of these deeper problems he had, Addison's disease and everything else. Anyway, that was one trick. And then coming in at the last minute, they timed it so that Nixon wonders, what's going on here? He's all flustered. Kennedy's not there. It's 3 seconds to finally come whipping in. And then treated Nixon like he'd never met him in his life, which is Kennedy was quite good at, that cold sort of Yankee chill he gave him. The other what was the other thing about
The recount after the election Jack finessed that, yeah.
Again, he manipulated Nixon, his old buddy. He had a meeting cooked up. He had his father call up Hoover, Nixon's hero, Herbert Hoover, and he got Herbert Hoover, who was kissing up probably to Kennedy's father, was very rich, arranged to have Nixon meet with Kennedy. So he wired it brilliantly in a way that Nixon couldn't reject meeting with him. And then Kennedy said, I'll come to you. You don't have to come to me. And he went down to Key Biscayne where Nixon was, and they met very formally and very nicely, and they sat and chatted over Cokes for about a half hour or whatever, just long enough to send the message that Nixon had conceded. There's one person in the country that could give a concession and make Kennedy, as you say, the illegitimate president, and that was the guy he beat. And so Nixon, knowingly or not, gave Kennedy the legitimacy to become a full-fledged president.
Chris Matthews is our guest. He's the host of Hardball. His latest book is Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. If you want to join our conversation with Chris Matthews, give us a shout, 816-235-2888. Our email address is updatedate@kcur.org, or look up KCUR's Facebook page. You know, two issues you got to ask about, Chris, Vietnam and Jack Kennedy's personal conduct.
Yeah, sure.
Let's start with Vietnam. I mean, Lyndon Johnson's presidency, obviously so damaged by Vietnam. Would Kennedy's administration gotten just as bogged down as a result of Vietnam?
There's two questions there. First of all, Kennedy's overall sense of the thing was much grander than Johnson's. In 1951, he'd gone over there and he had seen the situation and said, this is nationalism. Unless they give this country its independence, the French will never win this war. And, of course, the French weren't going to win a war that basically ended with them giving independence to Vietnam. That's why they were fighting for it. They wanted the colony. But he always understood it wasn't a battle of armament, firepower, or military prowess. He liked General Littré, the French leader, a lot. He was a French hero of all their wars in that period. And he was over visiting Littré, and he always looked up to him. In fact, when Littré died, he wrote this wonderful eulogy to him. But he said if no matter how many arms they had had at Dien Bien Phu in 54, they would have lost. So he never thought it would be one of these things where they could overpower the enemy in the way that Johnson later thought he could do, just huge air power and, mm-hmm. and manpower. Now to the question, what would he have done? I mean, you saw in 62 he was able to forge a papering over of the Laotian situation with the Geneva Convention, which created a coalition government. He did do that. There was the pattern of trying to do that. I think he knew he probably couldn't do that right away before the election in 64, but I think he would have loved to have done it. All kinds of evidence he was putting pressure on the Vietnamese generals to win the war. He helped them knock off Diem, the president who had been very pro-American, who was perhaps at the time planning to negotiate through the French to the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese to sign some kind of deal. There was some concern at that at the time. Ironically, that would have been the best deal for us, just let them cut the deal, get us out of there. But I think for Kennedy, Ted Sorensen, who's as good a witness on this as any, said he doesn't know what Kennedy would have done, and he's very liberal and very anti-war. He was a CO in World War II and about that time. He certainly came to see Kennedy, work for Kennedy as a former CO, a conscientious objector, and he doesn't know what Kennedy would have done. The thing is, there's a couple things. One is Kennedy never committed any combat forces. Mm-hmm. In fact, I have a story in my book about a combat an infantry leader who wanted to commit his outfit into a combat situation he thought was fortuitous, and he wanted to get into it. And Kennedy said, tell him they're in big trouble if they even think about it. I don't want them in any combat operations. So he still wanted to maintain the notion that we were there as advisors. At the very end, of course, he was threatening to pull troops out if they didn't play ball with us over there. That can be read a number of ways. He did ask Michael Forrestal for a complete review of all options, including an exit strategy. Forrestal was a dovish guy on the he was James Forrestal's son, and he was on the National Security Council and very close to Kennedy. Let's see. What would he have done in 65 had we still been in there when Johnson had to make the fateful decision about whether we let that government fall or not?
Yeah.
That's the tough one. Because, I mean, Johnson... And apparently, I'm not a military guy, but apparently to put military air bases in the country, you need to have a strong infantry component because you can't just put an air base in there without it being rocketed the first day you're there and just rocketed. So there's no air base left. There's no planes left. You can't defend them against open fields and jungles around them from being bombed and mortared. And so you have to go out there and clear the area. You have to go on patrols. You have to have an aggressive ground operation. And there you go. And that's how you get into it.
Yeah.
You can't just bomb. You have to put infantry on the ground. Then you're in the fighting, and then it's search and destroy the whole thing. And that's what Johnson got roped into. I'd like to think that Kennedy was so sophisticated historically that he knew that the country that lived there, the people that lived there would end up winning the war, and that we would eventually come home. Therefore, the people who stayed would eventually win. And therefore, the people who are most aggressive we're going to end up running the show, and that would be the North Vietnamese. But, you know, he was a politician, and he couldn't say that out loud going into that 64 election. Of course, Johnson was going into the 68 election later mm-hmm. on, and he didn't want to lose Vietnam. So he was in that predicament.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Hardball host Chris Matthews. When we come back, we'll talk about John F. Kennedy's blind spot. That, of course, is his personal conduct and his infidelity with his wife, Jackie. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Looking for a great B-movie? Our DVD gurus rattled off a wonderful list of Roger Corman films on Friday. You'll find their list, trailers, and our podcast at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the show, the history of Kansas City's fountains, plus a conversation with the Kansas City Rep director, Eric Rosen, about the company's new production of The Whipping Man. We're visiting with Chris Matthews from Hardball about his new book, Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. We'll be turning in a little bit to current affairs with Chris Matthews. But first, Chris, you know, if he had a blind spot, John F. Kennedy, it was his own personal conduct, and this is something that so many people still struggle with. He was not faithful to his wife, and as you point out, he left for a personal vacation right after the Democratic Convention in 56. He went on a sailing trip to the Mediterranean with his buddies, leaving behind his wife, who was 8 months pregnant at the time. She would then deliver a stillborn daughter. News like that was shattering to her. It would be shattering today if he was a candidate. What do you make of it?
Huh, that's a tough one.
Yeah.
I guess I have to address it from a couple of ways. What was he in relationship relation to Jackie or other women or other people. What was his drive and what was his concern about other people's feelings and his responsibility to other human beings? Clearly, he was a playboy. And I say that in sort of an old-time way. Before he was married, Billy Sutton, who was his first hire, he was his press secretary and a friend of mine for years. Billy lived with him in Georgetown, and he said he called it the Hollywood Hotel. I mean, Jack Kennedy, not only did he have a lot of girlfriends, they were always Vogue model girlfriends. They were not playboy. He didn't go in for raunch. He went in for absolute, exquisite, beautiful people. And these women were all like Jean Tierney, the models and the movie stars, and people like that. They were all, and then, of course, Inga Arvid, the Danish movie star, he was going out with before the war. He was going after the most beautiful women in the world, and he would have these relationships. He would fall in love a bit, and then have some other relationship, and he'd fall for somebody else. And this went on until he met Jacqueline in 51. And then he began a relationship with her, which was uneven. He would date other women while he was going out with her, letting her know that. You could argue that he was training her to who he was. When he did propose and they went to the wedding, a number of things happened at the wedding that are kind of odd. One of them was Lem Billings, who was his close friend, maybe closer to him than Jackie ever was, who was probably gay. Jack had him living at the White House in his own room. He had him in his life, as Joe Kennedy Sr. said, Lem came in with his tattered suitcase in his teens and never left. He was always a part of Jack's life. He went to see Jacqueline the day of the wedding, told her she was marrying a playboy, a guy that was probably not going to change, or certainly not soon. And then he went back and told Jack that he had told her, and he said, thanks. Figure that one out.
Really?
And then there was Chuck Spalding, who told me that he was a brilliant guy. Brilliant understanding Jack. He said they had kind of a chemistry relationship. He's a prep school guy, known him before the war, wrote a lot during the war, love at first flight, about being a naval aviator and things like that. Chuck Spalding told me he was at the wedding with Jack up at Hammersmith Farms up in Newport, and he said, I saw two men there in the same body. One was Jack, the bridegroom, playing that part, and the other was this omniscient observer, to use a literary term, who was like aware of everyone there and what they were all up to. He was always sort of cynically looking at everybody. What is he doing here? What's he up to? And what's Jackie up to, I'm sure, is included in his survey. And this is the way he was, by the way, in hearings, according to Clark Clifford. Later on, when they go to cabinet meetings and things like that, Clifford watched the same thing, Kennedy's sort of ability to have his spirit rise up in the air, look down among all the people and find out what they're all up to. So he could be very detached, is what I'm saying, very detached.
How did Jackie take this news from—
Well, Jackie, obviously, according to Charlie Bartley, who introduced him, she began to look rather sad, not the cheerful, buoyant Jackie that she had been before when she was— that wonderful name, when she was Jackie Bouvier. I just love that name. And when he won her, and then, but the thing about the Kennedys is it was also compartmentalized. I have a bunch of pictures, beautiful photographs of them, one of them in the book, or a couple of them in the book, of 1954 in Dumbarton Oaks, right above Georgetown, a beautiful setting. They're playing football, and there's Jack in his high-cut sneakers, and Jackie with her short sort of French-style haircut, looking wonderfully beautiful and pre-regal and wonderful, and that's at the same time his back is ready to kill him. And he's showing his first evidence of infidelity. And yet there they look like a perfect couple, along with Ethel and Bobby. So it never showed in the pictures. Jack continued to have affairs, obviously, all the way through, some of them serious, like Mary Meyer. And he was so compartmentalized that Mary Meyer, of course, was Ben Bradley's sister-in-law, Tony Bradley's sister. And all the times he was chumming around with Ben and his wife, Tony, they never knew about Jack's affair, which was live then at the time, active, with her sister. And so he was able to— – the way I compare him is to like a Titanic or an ocean liner. Every compartment was sealed off against the other. So he had his Irish mafia political guys who could be ruthless, incredibly loyal. He had his elite social friends, Charlie Bartlett, Chuck Spalding, David Ormsby Gore, who came for dinner at night. The Irish mafia were never invited for dinner. Ted Sorensen, in his own category, never invited for dinner, but always with Jack. He called him his intellectual brain trust, blood bank. And then he had academic friends like the wonderful Arthur Schlesinger, who I think is great, and Galbraith. And they were off in their quadrant. And then he had the girls, the serious ones and the unserious ones, the casual ones. And then he had Jacqueline. And the relationship with Jacqueline, if you listen to these hours of tapes that she did with Arthur Schlesinger, was a real marriage. And that's what's very hard to get to, because even though he was unfaithful, he had a full it seemed, except for trust, obviously, a full marriage with Jackie. She knew all his ups and downs emotionally. She knew about the Onions-Burke fight. I mean, her knowledge of Jack was pretty darn complete. She wasn't just arm candy, if you will, or just a beautiful queen to have around, although I think he was very aware of her regal quality politically to him.
The Onions-Burke
fight.
How
do I explain it except that right near the end he was having affairs with, not just having an affair, and a real love relationship apparently with Mary Meyer, because after Ziem was killed and he needed consolation, he spent the afternoon with Mary Meyer. And I think that relationship may have ended sexually by then, and it was just a close friendship, a close emotional relationship. He had these more casual relationships with these beautiful young women like Mimi Beardsley, who I knew. I'd met her back in a campaign in Brooklyn Heights back in 71, and or 74, rather, 74. I knew her. She was beautiful at 30. She must have been, well, she was 19 years old when she was having the thing with Jack. She's the woman who just wrote that book. I don't know how to explain it except that he was this detached.
And Clinton-esque.
How so?
Well, just in terms of the serial affairs he had ongoing while he was married.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know how he put it all together. He also had a compartment for his religion. He would go to confession right to the end, which he didn't have to do. Nobody was watching. He would go to great detail to get a Secret Service agent wait in line so he could go in and go to confession. He would pray at his bedside. Three different people told us that. It was clear that he had this habit of saying his prayers before he went to bed at night. He would go secretly kneel at the graves of his lost son, Patrick, who they lost in August of 63, and his beloved sister, Kick. He would go in all by himself and light a candle for his brother, Joe. He would be very reverential and devotional to his religion in a way that maybe non-Catholics can't quite get. But, see, he had that compartment for his religion, too, which makes it all. I mean, there's this wonderful story I came across. A friend tipped me off to it. And then I checked it out. The FBI, Hoover, was trailing him back in 40 before the war, and maybe in 41 at this point. And he was seeing Inga Arvid, who had had her picture taken with Hitler at the 36 Olympics in Berlin, and was a suspected Nazi. And he was hanging out with her. And when they shipped him down to Charleston to get him away from her, she came down for the weekend anyway, trailing him. They spent 4 days at this hotel. And the only time they came out of the hotel was for them to go to church together. So this guy, especially from somebody like me who's Roman Catholic, to try to figure out how he prayed, how he was devotional to his religion, even when no one was watching, and yet at the same time was breaking the rules. I kid in the book about him praying the prayer of St. Augustine, "Oh Lord, save me, but not just yet." You know, it's like he was enjoying his. I have to say that in the case of him and Clinton, you can bring up Clinton, who I was a tough one back then. I don't think anybody knows what it's like to be the object of such, for a male to be the object of such female appeal. That they were just, as Jackie called him, one of the nicknames was Magic. She called him Magic because he'd walk into a room and all the women would melt right in front of him. I've heard so many stories working for Tip of him and his. It doesn't seem real. It seems like some kind of perverse Superman who would walk in a room and women would come up to him and give themselves to him. I mean, it doesn't make sense. Yeah. They didn't have birth control then. These women were getting, you know, impregnated probably in these cases. He wasn't taking any protection or anything, any kind of concern about them. And yet you keep hearing these stories. I mean, he was very promiscuous.
Well, I'll explain that kind of magnetism to you off mic here when the show's over, okay? 816.
I don't think I've ever come across it.
Well, I'll introduce you to it. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, up-to-date at kcur.org. Chris Matthews of Hardball fame is our guest. His latest book, Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. Mike from Kansas City, Missouri, thanks for holding on.
Yeah, I could have 1,000 comments, and pardon me, your last mention about Clinton. Hell, Clinton, I mean, he was his hero, so he was trying to outdo him. Anyways, here's my question, and you answered everything except my question, two questions. Why did Kennedy get married? To look good, running for politics, and did he have to do exactly what his father told him to do?
Yeah, great questions,
well,
Mike.
Well, the first question is interesting. You never know what's in another man's heart. He was definitely taken with Jackie. She was unlike all the other girls he'd gone out with. She was regal, upper class, French. She was a Francophile, and she was very cultivated and absolutely stunning. I mean, stunning in a way most people can't imagine somebody looking She had these eyes that were so far apart you needed two eyes to look at her. I mean, they're just beautiful, like a stunning person to confront face to face. Incredibly well turned out. And I suppose fit the bill, to be cynical about it, in terms of if he has to get married, this is the person. He said something along the lines, sir, of Mike, of what may have judged. He said, she's the only woman I could have married. How do you like that one?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, doesn't that tell you a lot?
Like, yeah.
Okay, I got to get married. I can't just be a playboy literally from now on. I'm going to have to at least have the formality of a wedding. So I better do it. I have to do it. Or people, as he would say, think you're gay or something. Back then, they probably thought he figured that was part of the macho of his existence. And he was getting on. He was 36 when he finally got married, which is Irish and late. I got married at 34. It's not. It's unusually late for a guy who had all the opportunities, I suppose, he had. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
As for the old man, I don't believe the old man got him to do anything. I think the old man was somebody he pushed back against from day one. The old man was an anti-Semite. He was terrible as a person. He had no conscience about the war, the Second World War. He had no problem with Hitler and what he was doing. And Jack was very much the opposite. Jack was a fully assimilated American. He had American values. He understood the need for the war. He joined up, and not only did he joined up for combat. He practically killed himself to get into combat in a way that's so heroic. Going 55 months of trying to get his physical ability, his back fixed, he never really did. The old man loved his sons. He was closer to the kids than Rose was. Rose was really a chilling, distant presence. And I think that but Jack Kennedy would never have been able to be successful in politics if he had listened to the old man. The old man would have hired a bunch of hacks and kicked them in the butt. Jack had to use Bobby to get the old man out of that race in 52 so he could run a sophisticated, state-of-the-art campaign against Henry Cabot Lodge. And that was a real test. And the old man wouldn't have grasped at all what was necessary for that campaign. So he was there with the money. He was there with the public relations ability. He could get Jack played up in the local newsreels at the movie theaters, which nobody else can imagine. He was good for getting publishers like Luce and Hearst and all those guys to play ball with him. He was able to get reprints of articles about his son's heroism.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't make his son a hero, and he didn't make his son a politician, because you can't do that. I've been studying politics for 50 years. You cannot make a politician. They are what they are. They have the bug. I've never heard of anybody being talked into being a politician.
Did Joe Kennedy win Illinois for his son in the 60 presidential
election?
I
went back in my first book and I found out there were people who weren't alive, who voted. It was not decisive, however. It wouldn't have changed electoral college results.
So you don't buy the idea?
No, I don't. I do buy the fact there was serious hanky-panky, because there was at the time. There were dead people voting. Was it 5,000? Was it enough to turn that election? I don't know. All the ballots were burnt rather quickly. They were down the river, as somebody put it. Texas was about 100. Texas was different because there was a single party running the show there. There was no real poll watchers on the Republican side. Who knows what happened in Texas? But you'd have to combine a lot of these states to come up with enough to, or two of them at least, to come up with a plurality of electoral votes for Nixon. Nixon's problem was that he didn't have the even with Rogers, the attorney general on his side, William Rogers, he didn't have the ability to get the recounts. He also was a bit of, I'd say more than a bit of a patriot in not holding the whole thing up.
Yeah.
I think he recognized he couldn't win. So messing up Kennedy's parade wouldn't have been good for the country. I mean, I'm not one of those people that believe anybody's all bad. And I think Nixon, before he became very embittered after 62, was a better person.
Hmm.
He's a much better person before I got that deeply into politics, I think.
Well, Chris, let's play a hardball with a couple of current event issues that I know you're discussing on Hardball these days.
I wish I was an expert on anything happening today like I've become on Kennedy.
Yeah, I get that.
It takes years and years of digging and listening to so many sides of it, and the oral history, the documentary history. It takes so much to check out what some people say against other people, and I really made a point in getting the book to answer the question, what was he like, which is what Jack said was the reason people read books about people, especially historical figures, and why men tend to be more like this. I mean, in my household, I'm the nonfiction reader. My wife's the inveterate. I mean, she's unbelievable at reading fiction. My older brother was a fiction reader. I'm a nonfiction reader. But those of us who choose nonfiction are fanatical about facts. We don't want to hear oral history unless it's really backed up. And I think my book, it meets that test.
Well, this Trayvon Martin story is so painful for so many people down in Florida. And this obviously is the shooting to death of a young man down there by a neighborhood watch volunteer. President Obama last week talked about this in such personal terms, saying, if I had a son, he would look like Trayvon. What do you make of it all?
Well, I think the president was very, very careful.
Mm-hmm.
The way he talked about it, not in the way he talked about the Henry Gates case up in Massachusetts, where he did sort of jump the gun and taking sides. He said that, you're right, he said that in terms of empathy, and certainly he feels it from all the evidence we've got of him as a young African-American boy. I mean, he thought of that, like being his son, perhaps. He said he'd look like me. That's a pretty strong statement. But he also said, let's try to get the bottom of this, what happened. And I think that's the right direction for journalists. I mean, people who
are because we still don't know yet, do we?
We don't know, and it is important. But even then, I do recognize that once we get all the facts on the table, what looks to be probably what happened, there will be people with very different judgments about it. Suppose it is a fight. Suppose there was a physical confrontation. Suppose he was threatened at the end by the other guy, by Trayvon. Maybe he did feel threatened. We don't know any of this. And if he did, was he within his rights to pull that gun out of his holster? These are questions that the law, so I think we need at minimum. I haven't been able to get a hold of the police report. We haven't been able to get a hold of the interview transcript. Yeah. I hope they kept a transcript of the interview that was done with Zimmerman. How credible are all the facts when we put them all together? And by the way, we do have some good information just scientifically. I want to know who was yelling for help on that tape that the young woman was able to pick up on 911. If it was Zimmerman yelling for help or it was Trayvon Martin yelling for help, that tells you a lot, too.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Then there are people who will say it doesn't matter if it ended up he was threatened. He shouldn't have had the gun, therefore. So I think it's just going to be really hot, and there are going to be people like in the O.J. case where all the facts seem to be on the table. And there are going to be different points of view and passionately different points of view. And that's sad because it brings up the race problem, which I've always called the San Andreas fault in this country that divides us. And we don't need it, not at this time.
Well,
we just don't need it.
We're visiting with Chris Matthews of Harbaugh. You know, you can argue, Chris, that this president has spoken more about race than any other president. Has he done enough?
Well, you know, He comes from a mixed background. I think it's very important to understand he didn't come from a classic African-American background where his relatives were slaves at one point and had to suffer through the worst horrors of the pre-1960s period and all that has come since. That's not exactly, you know, heaven by any means. Ghetto living, denial of economic opportunity, broken families. We know the whole story of what's been the result of slavery over these hundred years. But he does have a wife who's been through that experience exactly. His kids are legatees of that world. And he is a great student of history, and he chose, I think, to live in an African-American setting, although very much the mixed setting. I think he clearly sees himself as an African-American, but he has a white mother, white grandparents, that unique kind of background, a loving mother who was very supportive. He has had a stepfather who is Indonesian. He lived in a third world environment for all those years. He had an African father. His blood father, who skipped. I mean, it's an amazingly complicated thing. But the joy of it is the number of perspectives this man has.
Mm-hmm.
That he can see things from a lot of perspectives. And his ethnicity is in this country, you know, one drop of black blood and you're black. And that he knows that, too. And he lives with that. And yet it's just fascinating the way his mind and his heart must work on these cases. What are the impulses that he follows? I know he's been careful because he knows he's from still a minority race, and he has to be careful about how he rules the whole country. But I'll tell you, there's something wonderful about the way – maybe we're not a post-racial society, but I think he is. And I think I watch the way he works with people. And people tell me he just doesn't judge people that way, that he does not judge people racially, you know, individuals. He does – and you know, one of the wonderful things I got to do in my life was to go to Africa and work in the Peace Corps. I would be the only white guy there and develop personal relationships with lots of people of a different color and different race than me, ethnicity. And it is a wonderfully liberating thing. And he, in his way, because of his upbringing, has had this life thrown at him, this mixed life. And it's so interesting the way he works with different people. He has African-Americans working around him. His friends tend to be African-Americans from Chicago. He mixes that with his professional relations. It's very much like Jack Kennedy has these compartments, apparently, that he works with. And he's happy. That's the key thing. This guy, and you don't want an unhappy president. he's almost joyous at times when you're with him. I've only been with him four or five times, and I always walk away from the table saying the same thing. This guy ought to be president.
Do you think
that's an objective statement. When you sit and watch him do his tour d'Ori zone of all the issues and his comfort with discussing them with you and giving you off the record his political assessment, you go, wait a minute, this guy ought to be president. It's not just he was elected and he's legitimate, obviously, but God, his command of the scope of his responsibilities is so powerful and so impressive to anybody with an open mind.
Does he deserve a second term, Chris?
Well, I think it deserves up to the voters. I think we're going to have a very hard-to-call election this November. I'm not saying too close because I don't know if it's going to be close. I know it's impossible to predict. I know that we have exogenous factors, outside factors, like gas prices, which are going to go up again this summer because they always do. We know that Iran could happen in 2 months. It could not happen. I'm not sure which helps or hurts them, but the consequences that could come from an Israeli attack or a combined U.S.-Israeli attack or an American attack on those missile sites, those the nuclear sites, rather, could have unexplained, unpredictable results. We have no idea. It could be the right thing to do. I don't know where I stand on that. It could be the right thing to do, but it will have consequences. Political consequences here at home. The unemployment rate, the growth rate. Suppose we have a growth rate that settles down around 2%. The unemployment rate goes back up near 9. Don't bet on Obama in that scenario. On the other hand, if he's managed to stabilize the unemployment rate in the low 8s, if the growth rate perks up beyond 2.5, and the gas price thing settles down in September and October, and we get an October unemployment number that last weekend before the election, and the debates are basically even steam with him with a slight. I think he'll have a slight edge in the debates, not a big edge, but a slight edge. I think Romney's quite good in these debates.
Mm-hmm.
Say Romney wins one debate, he wins two, so it's not a big decider. The vice presidential thing is relatively even. I put a Portman in there, somebody pretty sound will be able to match Biden. So I look at this as a political student, and I think this is going to be a very hard to call election. Based very much on circumstances.
You know,
so I don't know if that sounds right or not, but it's what I say. So,
you know, despite having worked for Democrats, Chris, and one of them was House Speaker Tip O'Neill, you have said, "I'm more conservative than people think I am. I voted for George W. in 2000. Did you really?
Yeah, I voted straight Democrat all my life, except for Michael Steele for senator, for Connie Morell for Congress. These are moderate Republicans. I thought we needed an African-American in the United States Senate, and Michael Steele always struck me as a good guy, even if he is much more conservative than I am.
Mm-hmm.
He's on our program. You can probably tell I like him. I'm buddies with him. Not buddies, but friends. And so I voted for – I thought that Al Gore ran a campaign of fear, and I thought that he ran on – a total negative campaign. He never talked about the successes of Clinton's of his 8-year presidency. He never bragged appropriately about the economic success of the 90s. He was fearful and almost afraid. And then those weird behaviors in the general election where he would confront George W. on the debate in weird ways. I think he's strange. I'll tell you, I still think he is. And the way he took the loss of going off and growing the beard and hiding and going off, and well, now maybe there's some sense that he did a great job with The Inconvenient Truth, but it basically been almost, I don't know what the word is. I don't want to use words that will be quoted, but I think there's something about him that made me not vote for him.
You know, one time he was here in town.
I also thought, I'm going to finish the thought, I was wrong about George W. I thought he had good, above-average instinct and intelligence, that although he was running against the academic elite and playing that card, I thought, and based upon conversations with him and other people's conversations with him out in Hollywood, for example, people met him, he seemed to be a guy that had good common sense and would not become some world warrior. He said we need a humility in our foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
I said, wow, thank God somebody's finally said we're not going to rule the world. And then what did he do? He got in the company of the neoconservative guys with these strong ideologies, are very well-read people, very informed on the Middle East, and Dick Cheney got in there, and I think they had a lot to do with influencing a guy that could possibly have been a better president had he done the homework of bringing in better advisors.
How difficult was the transition for you, Chris?
But I admit, I may have called, but may I maxima call?
Yeah.
I don't have to. I try to tell the truth about my mistakes, too. I mean, I make them.
You were once D.C. bureau chief for the San Francisco Examiner. 2 years ago, you were in 2 years, you spent as being nationally syndicated for the San Francisco Chronicle.
I syndicated actually the whole time. Yeah, I syndicated actually with the Examiner, and then the Hearst organization bought the Chronicle.
Then you became a national TV talk show host. How did you manage that transition?
How do I do 6 shows a week and do a book? How do I write books?
Yeah.
I'm crazy. I'm insane.
Are you?
I am saying I get up in the morning at, when I have to, very early, 5:30 or 6. I'll stay up until I fall asleep. I fall asleep over the word processor. I've been very fortunate in documentary sourcing and oral histories and interviews. And I think a lot of people trust me. Political people, because they know I like politicians. I'm not out to to bring them down. I'm out to try to find out the story they have. And
but going to TV, was that a hard transition for you?
I first appeared with McLaughlin Group, mm-hmm. and then I got the chance with CBS Morning News every morning, every week for a couple of years, and then Good Morning America. And then along came it was such a Roger Ailes was running CNBC and this new network called America's Talking, and I met him through Joe McGinnis, the guy who wrote all those books, like mm-hmm. Song of the President. And I met him one night in Los Angeles at the Four Seasons. We had a couple beers, and we hit it off, and it came time for him to run that network. And I said, how about that show we were working? I came up with the idea back in the early 90s of a half-hour show that would probably appeal to your listeners. It would be for people that don't watch much television, who are very busy, half-hour time capsule of only the most important, exciting things that happened the previous week. Mm-hmm. Maybe a great film came out. Maybe there's something in sports. But it had to be fascinating. Hmm. And it would be a fast-paced show like Hardball.
You're not going to run for – you talked about running for the U.S. Senate. You're not going to do that again, are you?
I may talk about it, but I'm not going to do it.
Not going to do it. Okay.
I have no idea. I'm getting old, but I tell you I wish young people would devote themselves to a 25-year career right now, or listening, because that's what it takes to prepare yourself to offer yourself for president. And unless young men and women are willing to make that 25-year commitment to building up a trade craft of learning how to be a political leader and mastering not just the policy but the people of this country, we're going to have a short list like we had this year of weak candidates. That's what I worry about, the replacement year on the Republican side.
Chris, it was great to have you. Thanks for taking some time, okay?
Hey, Steve, you're a great interviewer.
Thanks, I appreciate it. That's Chris Matthews, host of Hardball and The Chris Matthews Show. His new book is Jack Kennedy, Elusive Hero. Tomorrow on the show, the history of Kansas City's fountains. We had help today from Danny Alexander, Kathleen Pointer, Maria Carter, and Kim Noble. Our show is produced by Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date. Thank you.